Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the true story of the Mitford sisters. Uncover the full uncensored story of one of 20th century Britain's most notorious families, whose controversies and larger-than-life personalities dominated the headlines in the turbulent 1930s. Outrageous, now streaming only on BritBox. Happy Saturday. It's June 14th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Well, it's been another horrifying week in the news. Around 250 people have died as a result of an Air India crash in Ahmedabad. Trump is using the National Guard to quell dissent in the United States, and Israel is now at war with Iran. We are going to leave those matters for other news outlets to parse, at least for the time being. And we have an episode of Morning Meeting that will hopefully give you a bit of a break from all of that news.
Yeah, you know, it may feel like the world is going to hell, but for Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez, it's a bonfire of the vanities moment. In a little under 2 weeks, the billionaire and his crew of friends will take over Venice for the wedding that will be a three-day party, and Stu Heritage is going to tell us what we can expect. Then, speaking of billionaires seizing control of beautiful destinations, Joseph Bollmore is going to report from the Cotswolds on how Steve Schwarzman, the billionaire chairman and CEO of Blackstone, has ruffled feathers among locals. And finally, there might have been no fashion designer more beloved in New York City than the late Kate Spade. Her co-founder, Elise Ahrens, has written a book about her, and she'll join us to discuss how Spade went from being a broke student in Kansas to the woman whose name was on every New York woman's purse. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, I don't think we have a choice. I think we have to start with love, right? Or at least a wedding. And Stuart Heritage, a writer at large at Airmail, is here to take us inside the latest goings-on in Venice. He is the author of Bald, How I Slowly Learned to Not Hate Having No Hair and You Can Too, which, by the way, would be a pretty good wedding gift for Jeff Bezos. Welcome, Stu.
Hello.
So, Stu, I know I speak for you when I say that Venice is one of the most beautiful cities in the entire world, and yet I've never been so happy that I'm not going there this weekend.
All the people who I know who come back from Venice say it's too busy and it's kind of inaccessible to everyone. But that was before Jeff Bezos decided to get married there, which is happening in a couple of weeks. And he is basically bought the city to do it. He spent $10 million on his upcoming wedding. He's hired out every single water taxi in the city to ferry his guests about. He's booked out 5 luxury hotels completely. The Reddit page for Italian tourism is just blanket advising people not to go to Venice, almost as if there's been some sort of, you know, insurgency.
I mean, the craziest thing to me is that this seemed to be a desired outcome by the Venetian administration, right? There was some sort of a campaign to make this wedding happen there.
Yeah, that's the sort of the bizarre thing is that it's almost like the sort of the Olympic selection committee. Apparently a bunch of locations went to Jeff Bezos and pitched themselves to him, and Venice won out.
Look, we know it looks really good on Instagram, so I assume that that's one of the reasons. But is there anything else we know about why they selected Venice of all possible cities?
I don't know. I mean, in terms of logistics, it has a film festival every year, so it's used to lots of people coming and going. It's hosted G7 summits, so it's got the security factor. But at the same time, it does seem to be like a particularly odd place to have a wedding, especially Jeff Bezos has got a $500 million yacht that requires its own $75 million backup yacht. And it's so big that it can't really get into Venice. So it's going to have to dock quite a long way out of the city. It seems very impractical.
It's like more power to the Venetians. You know, like they saw a big whale. They're like, we can get this. I mean, God only knows, like, what Bezos really needs is Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to come in. Like who's reviewing the bids for this thing? Like $100 million, like any wedding planner, you'd be questioning everything. But I'm sure it's just like, good on the Venetian. Just like, we're just going to get this guy and soak him for all he's worth.
It has been very, very contentious because Venice is a city. I think there was a study that worked out it has maybe only 30,000 permanent residents, but then, you know, millions and millions of people come in and out. The core of sort of actual residents are just constantly up in arms about everything. I wish I could remember his name. I can't, but there's a guy who I quote in the piece who I Googled his name and anytime there's anything about Venice, he's like the go-to guy. He was the one who wanted cruise ships not to come back after COVID. He's calling for like a bigger tourist tax. It seems to be a microcosm of sort of the theme parkization of Venice.
Stu, I'm sorry to ask you to do this, but please take us through the guest list.
Oh, the guest list, it's great. It's everyone famous is going. Donald Trump might be going. Donald Trump's daughter might be going. Donald Trump's son-in-law might be going. Some Kardashians are probably going. Maybe Barbara Streisand. It's anyone who is anyone. Although I was reading something, Marina Hydro in The Guardian, and it was very fascinating in that nobody invited seems to know either Jeff Bezos or Lauren Sanchez for any meaningful amount of time. There are no old school friends or nobody they met at university. It's just the famous people that they hang around with now.
So it's like Harry and Meghan inviting Oprah Winfrey to their wedding.
Yeah, that's exactly it. George Clooney, who I think he was interviewed on the television on the day of the wedding, just being like, I've never met them. This is exciting, which is a strange rationale for a wedding guest list. But, you know, if you're the second richest man in the world, I guess you can do what you want.
All three of us are married, right? And I've only been married once. Do you too?
Yes.
Michael, you too?
Yes.
Okay. So I have thought often about my wedding and looked back, and there were some lovely moments, right? But the key takeaway for me is I wish it had been smaller in scale. Like there were too many random friends. It was too big. It was nothing compared to what we're about to see from Bezos and Sanchez, obviously. But the older I get, the more I just want to be around friends, family, the people I really love, doing things that are meaningful and intimate. And yet they seem to have gone in the complete opposite direction. Like, what does that tell us about the state of mind of Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez?
Well, I think for them, $10 million is actually, that's what represents their intimate small scale thing. Last year, it was reported that they were going to spend, it might have been $600 million or something enormous on this enormous blowout event in Aspen. So this is a real, I think that there will be 200 guests. And yeah, that qualifies as small. But yeah, no, I'm completely with you. I got really angry on my wedding day because I had to stop and kind of take pictures and do stuff that I didn't want to do. So I would have eloped and done it in front of zero guests if I had the chance.
I would also posit, Ashley, many weddings take on the desires of the personalities of the bride. She's kind of usually the one calling the shots. This is not a wallflower woman, you know? I mean, I imagine also maybe the dress is going to have some revelations to it as well. I mean, she likes to put things front and center, as we might say, right? And sort of really get all eyes on her. So I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's no wallflower, right? And it has me yearning for the days of Bezos wearing that mock turtleneck and those bad Levi's just hanging out in Seattle. I mean, it sounds like a lifetime ago. Now he's like, you know, Mr. Muscle and Fitness magazine and doing all the longevity treatments. And, you know, I'm sure feeling great in the middle of this midlife crisis that he's having. Yeah, it's just a strange moment. I mean, I just have so much more respect for Mackenzie Scott, his first wife, wondering what she's thinking as she watches this horror show unfold.
I mean, she's done very well out of it. She's the 38th richest woman in the world.
But we never have to see pictures of her cleavage at the Met Gala, Stu.
No, that's true. And their first wedding sounds quite nice. They had it was at a club in West Palm Beach, I believe. And they had like a water balloon fight at the end of it. So it was very kind of low key and fun. Whereas this thing seems to have this rictus. Lauren Sanchez's Instagram page about her hen weekend was just full of people who sort of, they looked like they were copying other people who were actually having fun. There was kind of lots of posed photo shoots in matching clothes, and none of it looked interesting or fun. But going back to what you said, Michael, about the whether it's Lauren or if it's Jeff, I think the bachelorette party and their stag party, that's kind of indicative. We knew everything that happened in Lauren's one. They went to Paris. They had danced on top of a boat. They went shopping. Lauren apparently at one point had a handbag that was in the shape of the Eiffel Tower. That's the level of granular detail it went into. But Jeff Bezos went to Madrid, had dinner. No other details have come out. Now, that might be telling, I think.
You know, the only people who interest me that are going to this wedding are actually Bezos' children. He had four children with Mackenzie Scott.
I was going to say the same thing.
All of the children are very much under the radar. The oldest one is actually the only one whose name has been revealed. His name is Preston Bezos, and he's 25 now. And so there are three younger than him. So I'm wondering, are these children going to be there? What are they going to say? I mean, one of them at some point will hopefully write a tell-all if there is in fact a God. And that's the book I want to read.
Yeah, because also, I mean, the whole thing is like the second marriage is always the one where how is she? It's one thing for your father to be dating, but then it's like, this is the new person in my life officially. There's always that drama. So maybe that's the next good chapter we can look forward to.
It's making me feel like I have to watch it very closely now. I have to pay more attention to the actual wedding than I was anticipating.
Sorry, Stu. It's a journalist's job.
I guess it is. Look at me taking one for the team.
Thanks, Stu. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Michael, I can't believe your invitation was lost in the mail.
What if you just showed up? Two wedding crashers.
Something tells me that you'd like be taken out by a sniper rifle.
Exactly. Or a taser right to your neck and you'd be dumped in the canal.
God, you know what would make me so happy? Like, where's Borat when you need him?
Oh, there you go.
All right, well, let's move on to another absurdity, Michael. Rich people fighting over houses. Ooh, one of our favorite topics. Steven Schwartzman, the CEO of Blackstone, is our real estate offender of the week. And Joseph Bullmore, who is a writer at large at Aramel, as well as the editor of Gentleman's Journal magazine, is here to explain why. Welcome, Joe.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
We've been hearing all of these rumors of Americans moving to the UK to avoid the Trump presidency. And we certainly know of one prominent American who has, at the very least, invested in some real estate. So what on earth is Steven Schwartzman doing in Wiltshire?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a good rich history, as you say, of Americans sort of pouring into the Cotswolds, at least, for those lovely Golden Stones houses and all the sort of members clubs. Essentially, it's just an extension of West London where you've got a bit more land. But Wiltshire, the Wiltshire-Hampshire border part of things, where Stephen A. Schwartzman, who's the head honcho at the big private equity shop, Blackstone, he's gone out down there, which is kind of surprising. Until you realize that perhaps he's just trying to gain the last square in plutocrat monopoly, which is the sort of epic rolling shooting estate. And that's what Connaught Park is. But I think everywhere Stephen Schwartzman seems to go, and he's got this kind of house mania of collecting these incredible piles all around the globe. I'm sure we can talk about some of them. Everywhere he goes, he seems to ruffle feathers, to say the very least, of the neighbours. And he's done that again this week with this huge lake he's building, which seems to be quite mysterious.
Yeah, tell us about this property.
So the property is, it's a late 17th century estate. It's a kind of manor house, which isn't necessarily one of the most beautiful of its vintage. It's fairly plain, kind of, to my eyes, at least slightly wonkily proportioned. But it's most notable for being a kind of, it was founded as a deer park, as a hunting estate. And that's really what Schwartzman's £80 million investment is getting him. He's getting 2,500 acres, I think, of probably some of the most storied and varied shooting country in the whole of southern England. Purdy, who are, of course, the big shotgun makers, they write about the sort of beautiful topography of the place and how it is one of the best sort of grouse spots in the country. So I imagine it's that kind of hunting estate aesthetic that Schwartzman wants. He's got everything else.
Oh, please, Joe, don't hold back. Take us inside his many estates all over the United States and abroad.
Yeah, I mean, I describe it as a kind of house mania. And I think in the piece I say he's a kind of modern day Ozymandias. In 2008, he did this rare profile with The New Yorker. And one of his immortal lines is, "I love houses. I'm not sure why." I think you could probably guess that he's, I don't know, grasping for some sort of epic permanence with these huge, huge piles, which he seems to collect all around the world. He's got Miramar, which is one of those amazing sort of old robber baron properties in Newport, Rhode Island. He's got a huge pile in the Hamptons. He's got a massive place down in Palm Springs, which he demolished a year after getting it in and got locked in a sort of 14-month battle, I think, with the Preservation Trust. He's got a Saint-Tropez villa. I mean, if you can think of the sort of classic plutocrat layers, he's got the biggest one. I think his net worth is sort of $43 billion. So $80 million here, $100 million there, that is kind of rounding errors for him. But he's certainly going on a spree in his 70s to tick them all off.
Yeah, this is sort of like the equivalent of us buying a new pair of shoes, right?
Yeah, exactly. But shoes probably are slightly less controversial than what Schwartzman seems to get up to. And this is the sort of, I guess, the peg for this piece this week, because he's constructed on this amazing shooting estate this huge lake, which I can only imagine is set to be a kind of fishing lake, so that he's got every single kind of animal hunting you could want in one place. But it's been historically quite a dry few months in England, which is a rare thing to say. And farmers around that neck of the woods are kind of slightly concerned about their own reserves of water. And yet at the same time, somehow, Schwarzman's Lake has been steadily sort of filling up this vast reservoir, which has led all the kind of local farmers and his neighbours to wonder how on earth he's getting this water. And the theory right now, which has been raised quite vocally, is that he's in fact drilled a borehole, or his people at least have drilled a borehole into the local aquifer. I'm not a geologist, but essentially that means it's a shared sort of reservoir of water below the surface level of the rock, which basically is a kind of a natural source for everyone in the local area. So if you're boring into it, you're sort of, I guess, borrowing other people's water at source, to put it generously. I should say that Schwarzman's estate say this is not true. In fact, they've just got a very highly sophisticated water collection system, which is somehow siphoning more rainfall than seems to be available. So yeah, the saga continues with Stephen Schwarzman slightly irking local neighbours.
Yeah, it seems like he likes to move at great scales. You also know what I mean? Like the grounds, he's known for shooting, you know, bird shooting in the British sense, which is fine. But now he's like, of course, like the rumors of you, as you report, have gotten out that it's not just a bird here, bird there, but like, we're going to do 500 at a time, right? Let's just like wipe it all out. Just like anything when these plutocrats do, like, I want the most at once done.
Yeah, definitely. I think the quote from the locals is that he's going to be putting on 500 pheasant days, which is, yeah, a pretty hefty day for the pheasants and for whoever's sort of gathered there to for the jolly. Yeah, I think that's definitely to the north end of what happens. And yeah, essentially at some point, and I think I quote one of them in the piece, is that sport when the sky above you is sort of thick with pheasants and you can barely miss one because there's 20 coming over a peg at a time. It's the sporting element slightly taken out of it, and it becomes a bit closer to fish in a barrel. But we'll see. The rumours of 500 pheasant days, who knows? They might be a little bit more abstemious on the birds, so to speak.
I mean, Joe, this just seems like an awful lot of kerfuffle for a home where Schwarzman is going to be spending, what, 2 or 3 weeks a year at best?
Yeah, it is. I often wonder with these things, what happens in the days they're not there? Because I can imagine that he's not going to go there before October, and it gets a bit cold and unpleasant down here from, I guess, late November through to March is pretty bleak. So I can see the scenario where he's down here with friends for sort of 5-6 weekends of the year. I think I did a piece for you guys 2 years ago about these great estates in the Cotswolds that have been brought up by wealthy Americans. And there's one story in there of a full-time staff who are kept on high alert at all times, living in this palatial place, I think in Gloucestershire. The owners come maybe once, weekends a year, without any kind of notice, but they want it ready at all times just in case they drop in from St. Moritz or wherever they happen to be at that moment in time. It's an odd way to live, isn't it? And an odd use of finite resources like housing, perhaps. But we'll stay away from that, perhaps.
Yeah, and perhaps one more explanation for why class warfare is engulfing our society. But again, you know, we'll skip that for now.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I make the point, and it's a slightly tongue-in-cheek point, with his kind of new ports, his Rhode Island property, and these grand, lavish parties he's putting on constantly at these places, he does seem like a kind of late capitalist Gatsby who's in search of something that he's never going to find. I think he's in his mid to late 70s now, and he's still acquiring things, still putting on huge bashes with celebrity guests and fancy friends. And it's sort of like, when will you reach the spiritual green light at the end of your dock, to extend that rather clumsy metaphor? I don't know. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of pheasants who are in slightly worse shape because of it, perhaps.
Well, Joe, thank you so much.
Wonderful. Lovely to chat, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the true story of the Mitford sisters. Uncover the full uncensored story of one of 20th century Britain's most notorious families, whose controversies and larger-than-life personalities dominated the headlines in the turbulent 1930s. Outrageous, now streaming only on BritBox. Well, we do have one love story, and it's a love story regarding female friendship between the late designer Kate Spade and her best friend and frequent collaborator Elise Ahrens. Elise has a beautiful new memoir out about her friendship with Spade. It's called We Might Just Make It After All, and she is here to take us inside of her story. Welcome, Elise.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Elise, I'm so excited to read your book, not only because I have loved Kate Spade since I was a teenager, I also am from Kansas, like the two of you, and your story was so inspirational, but also because of her incredible life story, you know, not only as a creative visionary, but also as a mother and a wife and a friend, and no one knew her in that capacity better than you. So what inspired you to write this memoir of your friendship with her?
Well, you know, I think so many remember her for how she left us.
and not how she lived. And I wanted to tell the story of her and all of the great times that we had. And it's truly a story about a best friendship of two women and trying to make it.
And how did the two of you meet?
We met when we were 18 years old at the University of Kansas in the freshman dorm of GSP, the first day of school. And there's a whole week called Country Club Week when school starts that are, you know, full of parties. And you also have class registration, but the parties are what everybody goes for. And we met the first day, did not think that we would be friends. I think either one of us thought that. I had just returned from New York from a trip with my family. And of course, I was wearing purple parachute pants and a, you know, crazy top and green pointy-toed boots that I'd bought on 8th Street. And Katie was wearing a polo shirt with the collar popped up and khaki shorts and Wegian loafers, which was really the uniform of college back then. And I had a lot to learn.
What initially drew you two together?
When we were going to register for classes, we started talking about why we were both majoring in journalism. And it turned out it was the same thing. It was that we were huge fans growing up of Mary Richards on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And she had really inspired us to dream bigger. And she was such a confident, modern woman of the times in the 70s and was working in a fairly male-dominated field. But she did it on her own. And she was cool and stylish and confident and really a cultural icon for us. And Mary was the reason that we both majored in journalism.
So how did you two go from being journalism majors to the life forces behind one of the biggest American fashion brands of the moment?
It's pretty crazy. We had both wanted to have a business together when we were in college. And we had no experience aside from bartending and waiting tables. And so when we found ourselves in New York, you know, fashion was really the area that we wanted to go into. And Katie got a job at Mademoiselle Magazine, and I started working in marketing for a couple of different fashion companies. And we kind of moved up in the ranks at, you know, both of our jobs. And it was actually Andy Spade's idea to start a handbag company. Katie was thinking of leaving Mademoiselle, and she'd been there 6 or 7 years by then, and she was a senior fashion editor. And she was just thinking, I want to do something else. And she didn't really know what to do. But she had the idea to create handbags that she couldn't find out in the marketplace because she had been the accessories editor at Mademoiselle. And she was, you know, she covered jewelry and scarves and hats and gloves and handbags. And she said, you know, there's something missing that's just not available for all of the photo shoots I want. And so she started thinking about what she would want that to be. And she cut out craft paper and taped it together with Scotch tape and said, this is the shape and the style I want in really unique materials, not leather, but doing something in fabric. And she had the first samples made. And they called me one night and said, we know what business you guys should do. And it ended up being four of us who were partners in the business. Andy was sort of the marketing genius behind everything. Kay designed everything. And then we'd met our other partner, Pamela Bell, who did all of the production and product development. And I did sales and marketing.
And by all accounts, including yours, it was a very happy marriage for a very long time. I mean, usually when you have that many cooks in the kitchen, so to speak, especially in the fashion world, there can be untold dramas that unfold. Why do you think you all managed to work so well together and grow this into the business it became?
You know, I think it started with our friendship. And we all respected each other. We were very loyal to each other. And nothing really broke that bond. No matter the tough times we went through, being broke, panicking, you know, a deal gone south, whatever it was, we were all still together at the end of the day. And one of the things that we had all decided early on was if this thing was really going to work, that we would hire only really creative, curious, and gracious people. So when we would take out an ad in Women's Wear Daily for help, a help wanted ad, the very last line on it was, must be polite, because we wanted to work with all nice people. And we ended up doing that. It was a really, really great team that we had at Kate Spade and at Frances Valentine too.
So Kate died in 2018. And here we are 7 years later, really her influence in many ways has only grown stronger over the years. And the love and adoration that not just the fashion industry had, but, you know, the entire universe of style, an entire generation of young women. What inspired you to write this book about Kate? And did you have any hesitations about putting your story out there?
You know, what inspired me to write it is we had so many wonderful experiences together. And I really wanted people to understand the magic that happened in not only our best friendship, but also in creating two businesses together. And, you know, they're normal. There are ups and downs and highs and lows, just like everybody has. And all four of us who started Kate Spade were from the Midwest. And here we are, you know, these young people starting this business. And it was, you know, it was something that just took off. It just hit. And from that point on, we were running for the next 13 years. We worked and worked and worked and worked. And it felt like 24/7. It was like your first child for us.
And you all sold the business to great fanfare. And then years later, you decided to give it another go with Frances Valentine.
Michael Kors said to Katie at one point, "Why are you sticking your hand back in that blender? You're free, you're free." So yes, we sold the company in 2006 to Neiman Marcus, and we had agreed to stay on for 6 months and help with the transition. We did that. And then, you know, I kind of found myself at a loss. I didn't really know what to do with myself because I'd never not worked a day in my life. And Katie felt similarly, although I think she was happy not to be so busy as we were. Because, you know, she had to be the face of the brand. So for her, it was nice to have some time off. But we both ended up volunteering at our children's schools. And she ran her school store. And I became PA president and then later a board chair at my school. And it was really a great period. I learned so much during that period, you know, working in a volunteer, you know, situation, and really learned so much from all the people at a nonprofit, which was great. But we both really missed fashion and we missed creating things. So we started talking in 2014 about a new accessory business. And we started Frances Valentine. It launched in 2016 with handbags and shoes. And, you know, we'd been out of the business for about 8 years. Social media didn't exist when we sold Kate Spade. So we had a lot to learn about, you know, e-commerce was king and influencers had taken over from editors. And so all of the things that we really knew had sort of changed. And so we were up for the challenge. We had a lot to learn and we, you know, started working on all those things and business was going great. And in 2018, that's when we lost Katie. Having the business at the time was probably a good thing because it helped me get through that loss. And I felt like she was still with me a lot of that time. And we created a couple of things as a tribute to her. One was a caftan that she wore on all vacations that we'd taken together. She and I were huge vintage shoppers. So everything we owned, you know, we had a lot of vintage. And another was a vintage embroidered sweater that she'd worn for, you know, decades. And so we remade those two items and they sold out immediately. And it really felt like that was our inspiration for having apparel in Frances Valentine. And it really kind of created a new life for the business, which was really, really great.
Kate Spade kind of ruled the 90s and the aughts there. 90s are back. I mean, you must hear from mothers with daughters now whose daughters are probably like stealing their old bags out of the closet. Is that true, I would imagine?
I hear all the time, and women come up to me at events and, you know, if I'm out anywhere and they tell me, I still have my first Kate Spade bag. And I think that bag is particularly special for that generation of women who grew up with it, because as a young professional, it was the first thing she bought herself when she started working. So it's more than just a handbag or a designer bag. It's meaningful to her because it signaled a time in her life when she made it. It was the first time she was ever able to purchase something for herself. And I think that's why those pieces mean so much to those women. And yes, I hear from them all the time. And I love it. It's so nice.
Elise, congratulations on the book and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. Airmail's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at ml.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at ml.news/wic. I'm Chris Garrett, ML Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, well, Michael, if that is not a weekend recommendation, I do not know what is. But I'm sure you do have something else to keep us occupied this weekend. Please?
I do. We touched on this a little bit ago. Have you watched Friends and Neighbors with Jon Hamm on Apple Plus TV?
I have watched a few episodes, Michael, and I'm sorry to say I just can't get into it. It's like the suburbs, alcoholism, financial troubles. It's just too distressing for me, but I know it gets better.
It gets better. I mean, this is, you know, as I said, it was Jon Hamm, and it plays a guy who's big, you know, master of the universe, loses his job, lives up in, you know, whether it's Greenwich or somewhere up in Westchester. And what does he do in order to sort of like keep the money coming in? He decides to start robbing, breaking into the houses of his very, very wealthy friends, and how things sort of spiral out of control. I liked it a lot. Hamm is always great. And you know what's sort of curious? I know it might be a little close to home for some of us, but I feel like I know this world, but I really enjoyed it. I like watching Hamm and what he does. But, you know, curiously, it reminded me, and I was talking about this with a friend of mine, there's an old John Cheever story, which I would recommend you go back and read if you want. It's called The Housebreaker of Shady Hill, which I wonder if the creator of this show, because it's got these voiceovers. And anyway, and that's a great little Cheever story about this guy, Johnny Hake, who basically is a guy who lives up in Westchester back in the 50s, 60s, and resorts to housebreaking to save his family from financial ruin. So it's called Your Friends and Neighbors, and it is on Apple TV right now. And you, my dear?
I love that you brought up the Ovid of Ossining. I mean, Cheever is someone we should be revisiting almost every year. Have you read Blake Bailey's biography of Cheever?
Yes. Oh, for sure.
Even if you don't like Cheever's work, which is almost impossible, it's still a wonderful biography about Cheever. Okay, so Michael, I have been watching another show on Apple TV. It is called Stick, and it stars Owen Wilson as a golf pro trying to reinvent his life. Have you seen it?
I watched the first episode. Do you like it?
I really did like it. You know, it's sort of my Ted Lasso moment. I need a bit of positivity in this crazy world that we're living in. And Owen Wilson is such a compelling, fun, and friendly actor that I sort of love this. Also, it co-stars Judy Greer as his ex-wife, and I think they have a very sweet relationship. It's a fun one to follow along with a fabulous summer TV series, at least I think. Do you agree?
For sure. He's always great. And it's sports and it's very light. It's a good sort of like summer light, frothy little thing.
All right. Well, on that note, we wish you all a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Mike, would you please read us out?
Of course. And we want to thank our sponsor, BritBox. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our coders are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davison. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.